agenda will be SJR 40, the Permanent Fund Resolution, and we have Senator Helfert with us today to discuss it with the committee. Senator Helfert, would you join us at the committee table, please?
Is this on teleconference?
Yeah. We're not on teleconference.
You're on camera.
There were two people in Anchorage who were interested in the House bill, but no one on this one.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this, Madam Chair. What I'm passing out is a packet of just kind of related information. It includes the original constitutional amendment I introduced at the beginning of the session. It also includes the House Joint Resolution that moved out of this committee earlier in the session, House Joint Resolution number 1. It includes the existing permanent fund law. It includes an article from former Governor Jay Hammond on the stockholders' vote in permanent fund decisions. It includes three projections of permanent fund activity, the status quo, and the governor's financial plan of 227.87, and the governor's financial plan of 227.87, if in fact no new taxes passed, and the result of House-Senate disagreements would be that everything transferred over to the permanent fund column, because it seems that that might be a likely result. The final page is a combination of the charts that OMB provided at the beginning of the session as to where the revenue was going to come from for the 1987, 1988, and 1999 budgets. And in the corner of that chart, it shows the total effect on the permanent fund for those 3 years as the governor proposed it. It also shows the total effect if, in fact, the ELF postponement and the personal income tax fail. You can see there's a loss to the permanent fund of $1.34 billion, or the governor's original proposed reduction in permanent fund income of $845 million. It was these charts that that caused me to be concerned initially, and my first effort was to provide a fairly simple constitutional amendment that just dealt with permanent fund income. That was Senate Joint Resolution number 25. Now, it actually is fairly similar to what you'd passed out of this committee originally in House Joint Resolution number 1. You provided for a vote of the people on any law to change the system, where I provided that unless funding went to dividends or inflation certain, the appropriations had to be approved by the vote. In either case, it was an effort to provide some protection for the permanent fund, recognizing that there was going to be a lot of pressure on it this year, and we had a proposal on the table from the governor to use substantial amounts of funding out of the permanent fund. I think SJR 40 is essentially an evolved proposal that comes from that concern. We all recognize the pressure on the permanent fund, and SJR 40 is certainly not inviolate. It's the Senate's effort to try and provide a vote of the people before we agree to take funds out of the permanent fund. Now, we recognize that that vote may not occur before something happens dealing with the permanent fund, but it does allow the people of Alaska to essentially close the door on ever-increasing appropriations out of the permanent fund. And it is very strongly my belief that if the permanent fund income continues to rest on the table, it will be the target of every disagreement between the House and the Senate and the executive. The safety valve will always be spend permanent fund income. Now, some sides would argue for taxes to replace that. Others would argue for government cuts. That dialectic, I think, is normal, and it should be there. But with the permanent fund as a continuous safety valve for that debate, I believe the permanent fund will continuously lose in that argument. And I think you've already acted on one proposal to provide protection for the permanent fund. I think that proposal, as far as I'm concerned, would be a big step in the right direction. It's my position simply that we not take money out of the earnings until we guarantee the people a chance to vote on it. And whatever method you see in the House side as the best way to do that, I'm certainly willing to go back to the Senate and try and work on to see that it can be accomplished. So any questions on the proposal, I'd be glad to try and answer as to how they got there or why they got there. But I don't consider it all inviolate. It's simply a way to guarantee a vote.
I wonder if you would mind just very briefly going through the resolution itself.
Okay, I haven't got a copy of SJR 40 in front of me. I'll give you one.
Okay. It's the first time that this committee has looked at SJR 40, so if you wouldn't mind just sort of briefly going through it, I think it would be helpful.
Okay, the first section on page 1 dealing with the permanent fund is a permanent change in that the rest of the resolution has a sunset in it, but the change to provide that the fund is a trust.
Excuse me, just one second.
Sure.
For those of you who are looking at something called SJR 25,
okay.
Don't look at that.
No,
okay, that was the one of the original versions.
Right. SJR 25 is just background information.
Okay.
Yeah, go to your file folder and fill out SJR 40 finance amendment. Okay.
The first section provides a permanent amendment to the permanent fund portion of the Constitution, which establishes the permanent fund as a trust on behalf of all residents of the state of Alaska. It is my belief that was the intent of the original amendment, and it also adds that the principal shall be invested in accordance with the prudent investor rule. It essentially puts in the Constitution the current statutory provisions protecting the principal of the permanent fund. The next section deals with it is simply the conforming area in the dedicated funds amendment. The third section, you start to pick up the substantive differences when you come down to line 27. And you see that you've added the capital gains in excess of capital losses go directly to the principal of the permanent fund to help offset the effects of inflation and also to essentially stabilize the revenue stream of the permanent fund. Capital gains can be taken at varying times. And one of the things that the five-year averaging was advocated for and in fact did is it equalized the income stream, particularly when you took or you could take a $500 million or a $600 million capital gain in 1 year. That would have had a large swing in income because of that. With the five-year averaging, that was taken out. By putting capital gains into principal, it also takes out a lot of that incentive or that ability for the income of the fund to swing in large amounts. The next section goes to, and this again, of course, is not inviolate, but goes to what the Senate came up with as a method of splitting the income. It guarantees that 70% of the income will go in combination to dividends and inflation proofing, 40% to dividends, 30% to inflation proofing. The remaining 30% goes to a budget reserve account. The budget reserve account is constitutionally protected and includes this 30% and includes half of all revenue received above the spending limit, which is essentially the next major element of the proposal. The spending limit is simply prior year plus 5% adjusted for population inflation. One of the problems we have with the existing spending limit is when you get into indexes and try to figure it out on what your base is going to be, there's essentially a meaningless spending limit in the Constitution now. And this would tie it right back to your prior year always. Another point that I should make is that the revenue received over the spending limit is dedicated half to the permanent fund and half to the budget reserve account. So the essential effect is that if your highest priority is dividends, you have a constitutional guarantee of a dividend at 40% of the income of the permanent fund. If your highest priority is the inflation proofing and long-term health of the fund, you have a constitutional guarantee that capital gains will go into the fund, that 50% of any income over the spending limit will go into the fund, and that inflation proofing will go back into the fund. If your major concern is the stabilization of state spending in both directions, up and down, on the high side, you have an appropriation limit to limit increases to essentially 105% of the prior year. You have a budget reserve account to cushion decreases so that you don't see massive cuts that we've had to face in recent years. Now, it's a complicated proposal because it contains three essential elements. But when the elements are broken down separately, I believe it certainly fits together well. It provides some real protection for the permanent fund and its beneficiaries. And I think it's a reasonable proposal. But again, I have no problem myself with whatever the House feels works in this area to provide a reserve in spending, protection of the permanent fund and dividends, and an appropriation.
Okay, questions? Representatives Boucher, Martin, and Menard.
Well, first of all, I'd like to compliment you on this. I think that at least somebody is beginning to set down a set of ground rules instead of different uses for it. So I think that it's something that, you know, we got something to work with. One of the questions that I have, Senator Halford, is, all right, say we get a bonanza of a billion from some of these settlements. Could they not be marked to go in here? In other words, we talk about mineral leases, rentals. Now, if we have a settlement with somebody, would that see them come in here? Okay.
The provisions of the amendment provide that income from whatever source.
All right.
That is general fund income. From whatever source, goes half to the principal of the permanent fund and half to the budget reserve account. So essentially, additional income coming in doesn't simply go into the general fund and get appropriated into another massive spending spree.
Okay, I understand that if what you're saying then, if there's a settlement, and I don't know how much is out there, what?
$1.6 billion
all right.
Audited through 82.
We get the check. Does that check go this?
$800 million would go into the principal of the permanent fund. Of course, actually, what would happen is when you got a settlement, if it were based on the original dedication of the permanent fund, first the constitutional dedication and the statutory dedication would come out. And then this provision would split the rest of it, and it would go half again into the permanent fund and half into the budget reserve.
I know there are other questions. That's my concern. You know, that we get another $1.3 billion or $1.6 billion or something like that, and we're off to the races again. I just want to make sure that we're not basing our future on that settlement, you know, as an excuse to not deal with what we're doing today. So. I think, so that's another plus factor for this. Any settlement would have to go through this procedure here.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have four questions, but two of them come under the same heading of constitutionality. And one is, Senator, what is the latest? The reason why I say latest is because according to the different attorney generals, with that different opinion, depending on who's in office, about the people's right to vote on appropriations. Rebellion thrown out because they said that land equals money, therefore it's unconstitutional. There's another bill that we had that after the fact. What I'm worried about is that, you know, if we go for the constitutional amendment and everybody goes through the election process, then the attorney general or someone takes it to court and they said, oh, it's unconstitutional. And we've had that at least three times in the state so far. Also, within that constitutional question is a single issue ballot. And as you mentioned, we have three major issues here. AG ruled on the bill itself yet, on the constitutionality?
Well, on the constitutionality of a constitutional amendment, you wouldn't have any problem. You are amending the Constitution with regard to appropriation language, just as we did with the original permanent fund. The permanent fund represented a dedication of revenue, which certainly was an appropriation in a sense, and yet it was an amendment to the Constitution, the basic document itself. As far as being one subject, it is one subject. It does have three elements. And we do have legal opinions that state that that's the case.
Okay, it would be done that after the fact. Also, I personally feel a little safer with the statutory requirement that I think, I'm only guessing, that the House majority is in favor of. I really believe in that because in your bill itself, once you put something in the Constitution, it's supposed to be so good and so permanent that for generations, this thing will last. Here we have a cutoff date suspending it until 1995. And I wonder why the proponents of this put a suspending date in it.
Well, the reason, of course, to put a suspension date in was to try and deal with the objections of some people who didn't seem to want to stay committed to the permanent fund provisions or the inflation proofing provisions or the dividend provisions. I would not have put any suspension date in it. I would have allowed, of course, the Constitution to be amended later by going through the legislature and going through the normal process. But the question of putting it in the Constitution, I think, was probably best answered by former Governor Hammond. And he answered it in two ways. Once he answered it in 1975 when he vetoed legislation to create a permanent fund. If we, in fact, had a statutory permanent fund today, I think it would be endangered, not just in its income, but in its principle. The constitutional protection is essential for that reason, and of course it's also essential because it's a clear way to get a vote of the people. And they know that if, in fact, the legislature and the executive branch in combination take some of the earnings of the permanent fund, they won't be able to simply take more by amending the statute next year. And finally, we have the best example in what we've done in the last 8 months. At the end of the last session, we passed a statutory budget reserve account. That statutory reference provided that only 25% of that account could be used in any year. Almost the first combined action of the House and Senate in this legislature was to take the entire amount of the money and put it into the spending stream.
Last question I have, and let someone else talk. I'm in favor of switching to 40-30-30 to 30-40-30, because I really believe in building up that principle, and that 40% should go into inflation proof. And as long as we can afford it, I know it's going to become a time when it gets, the whole state is going to be taxed outrageously just to inflation proof it. But I'm wondering if the Senate would mind if the House concluded that
Well, I think the question is the collective wisdom of the combined House in balancing the interests of today and the interests of tomorrow. I mean, you can always say that it's easier to eat your seed corn and starve your future. But I strongly support inflation proofing, as I support dividends. I know that you've been opposed to the dividend program, and certainly that's your privilege. But I think it's a matter of whatever the collective wisdom of the House is in terms of how it should be put together. I think we're interested in working on that and working with the House on it.
Representative Menard was next, unless he'll yield.
I just want to know what he based his economic factors on. I mean, does he run some figures or something?
I'm not an economist. It's just, I've got to be on.
This isn't a dark board.
Representative Menard, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Excuse me.
Senator, when you refer to the spending limit and staying within 5% of the spending limit, what are you referring to? The monies that are in the budget reserve that we spent on the previous year, or are you talking about the total budget?
The appropriation limit provides that with the listed exceptions, which are out of the base for the prior year and out of the spending computation for the next year, that spending may not go up more than 5% of the previous appropriation. So what you have is the total appropriations for the previous year plus 5% essentially represent the limit for the next year. That's the maximum limit.
According to
if we go back and look at what happened when the price of oil went to close to $40 a barrel, you see that those increases went up astronomically.
Other questions for Senator Halford on SJR 40? I guess I'd just like to return to a point that Representative Martin raised, and that was why 40-30-30 was picked. If you look at the projections of what that balance, 40-30-30, does to the permanent fund balance over a long period of time, it shows a significant decrease in the amount in the fund once you go beyond about 2010. And there are some numbers that have been done, 33-33-33 or 50-25-25, that for the long term results in either a better fund balance, better dividends, ultimately, not the short term, but in the long term. I'm just wondering how much discussion went into the 40-30-30 and why you picked those numbers.
The 40-30-30 was picked to minimize any reduction in dividends, to match the past performance of the fund plus in terms of inflation proofing, and to provide a reasonable revenue stream for the budget reserve account to stabilize state spending. If you look at the permanent fund inflation proofing percentages in the past, you'll find that inflation proofing, I think, has taken something like 27% of the income of the fund. If you look at it in the future, based on the projections of the board, it's always projected to require more than that. And by the way, I support those projections because they're looking forward very conservatively. So they're always essentially saying that we're going to get 9% rate of return and 6% is going to be required for inflation. Inflation has been between 3 and 4%. If you cumulatively run it all the way back to the 40s, inflation this year is something like 3.9%. So if 40-30-30 were in place this year, which I'm not advocating, by the way, it in fact would put more than twice as much into inflation proofing as is provided by current law.
Like, on that Senator, I agree in the long run that, and I realize, according to current law, it's putting in a lot more, and perhaps if an interest cost decreases or stays at a minimum, we'll put more into the principal by far in place of proofing. But nevertheless, why not put some heavy emphasis on 40%, because in the long run, people will be getting, our children will be getting more dividends. Then also, if this takes place in 1988 election, is that an immediate effective date, and would that have an impact on the 88 dividends, or would it be the following year?
It would be the following
year.
It's, that's what it says in the legislation.
Any other questions for Senator Hopper? There are two other people who wish to testify on this resolution. If you can stay and listen to the testimony and answer the additional questions.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you very much. Mary Halloran is here from the governor's office.
Thank you, Manager.
Welcome back, Mary. It's been a few months.
I've actually had a few weeks break
you.
Here.
Yeah.
Okay, with me is Jack Cardinelli's staff in my office, who does the nitty-gritty dirt work on the permanent fund and the use of the earnings and what all these different proposals mean so that we have some sort of numbers running and analysis going on. I think first what we'd like to urge the committee to do is to be as judicious and thoughtful and deliberative as possible on this proposal, where it is a proposal for a radical change in the way where the permanent fund earnings are allocated, and we think that it needs a very thorough public debate and not only legislative debate, but very thorough understanding by the public at large as well as by the legislature itself. It does have major implications for the permanent fund dividend. More important to my mind is that it also has major implications for inflation proofing and the principle of the permanent fund. I think everybody recognizes at this point that the current statute has problems also that are going to have to be addressed at some point, particularly if the Senate does not agree to act on other revenue measures this session as the House has proposed. I think, as the Chair herself has pointed out in previous hearings, the legislature is basically going to be up against the wall next session in terms of how to use the permanent fund earnings. But this proposal also raises some larger questions besides the allocation questions. It first raises the question of the fund management. And we had some difficulty coming to terms with what does the term capital gains mean and what is it really going to, how is it that provision in the resolution going to actually work in the future. If you had taken the case of the last 3 years, about 30% of the fund's earnings in each of those 3 years was designated capital gains, and in which case if that pattern continued in the future, the principal of the fund, in fact, would be in better shape than under current statute because you would have 30% off the top going to the principal and then 30% of the remaining 70% going to the principal. And in effect, about 50% of the earnings would go to the principal, and that was a better protection than under current statute. But in talking with the Permanent Fund Corporation, they felt, and we felt too, that kind of capital gain taking that's been a pattern for the past 3 years is not in fact going to be the pattern in the future, or it's not a normal pattern. And as a result, the amount of money that's more likely to be deposited into the principal is less than would be available under even current statute. It also raises the question, I think a very large question, of do we then put the managers of the permanent fund in a very precarious position where they are managing the portfolio to maximize capital gains because that in turn protects the principal, and it is their duty under statute to try to protect the principal, or do they get into a very politicized position where they're managing the earnings of the fund in order to provide a larger revenue flow to the state than might otherwise be the case. So it also just raises the issue of who's actually controlling the flow of state revenues. And that's not to say that that control couldn't be moved there or shouldn't be moved there, but that that question needs to be considered very, very carefully. There's some issues. There are a number of other larger questions here that need to be thought about. One is just the question of dedicated funds. The makers of the Alaska Constitution were very, very careful to exclude dedication of funds. And they went through, I think, long and laborious debate on that particular issue and decided that dedicated funds were not an appropriate measure to be included under the Constitution. I think it raises the bottom line question in my mind is this, in a way, is an evasion of legislative responsibility. I think the chief role of the legislature is to appropriate. This resolution is meant to prevent the legislature from appropriating except in one fashion. And I realize that comes from some distrust by members of the legislature of their own future wisdom. But that's something that I think, as members of the legislature, you all need to consider. I think the final, another point is that needs to be thought about very carefully is, and it's the biggest question, is balancing fiscal flexibility, which would be some sort of statutory approach to using permanent fund earnings, versus predictability or, in fact, a rigidity in the future. I don't think it's any secret to anybody that the most difficult years of the Alaska economy are probably going to be the next 5 or 6. And I think it's imprudent to have a rigid way of spending the permanent fund earnings when I think we're going to be facing the most difficult years of our economic future in the immediate future. I fully agree with Senator Halford that the current spending limit is non-functional, meaningless, and that issue, probably does need to be addressed, and in particular in terms of our ability to direct large windfalls of money wisely. I think there's some narrower questions, like how does the 80% fall through the floor provision really work? The reliance on the permanent fund earning projections, when in the past the corporation nobody has counted on these earning projections to budget on. And here all of a sudden we're talking about budgeting on numbers that have not been used for those purposes in the past. And I talked to some of the trustees who thought that there could be as much as a 10% error factor in the earnings projections, and they didn't hold, it's not that anybody is at fault for that, but that these just aren't meant to serve budgetary purposes, and that they were just simply there for other things. I guess I agree totally with Senator Halford's concern about the potential impact in the future to the permanent fund if the Senate fails to act on other revenue measures. We would simply prefer that they act on other revenue measures. And Jack has some fuller descriptions of the impacts of the resolution. But
could I?
Two questions first. Representative Boucher and Mark.
Yes, Mary, I agree. You said judicial. We need to act as a judicial, and it's a radical change. Well, I think we'll all agree there needs to be some type of radical change, because if anything's been radical from the feedback I'm getting from the public, they think that we are absolutely nuts the way we're dealing with this thing. So at least this is something. One thing is, we talked about fund management, capital gains. Well, hasn't it been traditionally, and I'm not an economist, that during period of depressed oil prices, the capital gains have been high. So that capital gains began to go down, we would be, in essence, it'd be to Alaska's benefit, but inflation would tend to increase in the price of oil. Is that a fair assumption? In other words, should we not give both sides of the coin on that particular issue?
I think, Representative, you may be right in looking back over the last year or two that in some sense capital gains taking can be viewed as offsetting a decline in revenue. I don't think that it would always be the case, though.
No, you're missing. I probably stated wrong. In the world economy, never mind whether you take the capital gains, that's a management decision. Generally, we have seen high capital gains in the period of depressed oil prices. because generally the economy's doing better. Then, but we see when, and then the reverse is being true. The capital gains are down when the price of oil goes up. Right.
That's
now, is that not so?
Normal economic theory.
Yeah, so
now,
we have seen
these
cycles. My concern is that we might be just taking one snapshot of the entire thing. We ought to look at both sides of it. That means that there would be more dollars flowing directly from the sale of oil, which has been the case in the past, and there'd be plenty for everybody. But if there isn't some safety valve or where this stuff is put or some ground rules of whatever kind, I'm just concerned. There has to be something done, and this is about one of the few things that have been put on the table that appears to offer some type of structured solution. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. Before we get into details, one statement that you mentioned, Ms. Hallerman, was that no one counted on the onions to support the budget. And that's the thing that's in the very valid question. It was made very clear in the ballot question of that year, the voters passed it, that this is to be the reserve, the saving grace, you may say, for government once oil prices, or the oil, we never thought oil prices would drop down. We thought that oil would run out. And it was very clear in the ballot statement that this is to be counted on. That's the reason why we want to save as much as we can today. So I was kind of surprised when you meant that, unless you meant it in a different way.
I think I meant it in a different way. It would be our position that the permanent fund earnings are meant to be used, and the allocation of those earnings is a matter of legislative deliberation and action.
And as far as that goes, you do mention that there are alternative means of support the budget, supporting our services to the people and what they want in education and university. And I think that here lays the battle. So your advocacy, of course, is to support the permanent fund and watch that thing just grow and grow and grow.
Well,
and our advocacy is not to tax, my advocacy, I should say, is not to tax the heck out of people while this animal is growing.
I think, sir, when we discuss this question in terms of policy, what we've been trying to do is to avoid a short-term perspective and to look at a long-term perspective. If you look at the long-term perspective, you have to take into consideration the Prudhoe Bay revenue curve and the necessity for building the principal of the permanent fund to meet the needs of the state at that time. And I think that it's not a question in the minds of this administration whether or not to use the earnings, but when to use the earnings. And that's the subject, I think, of necessary public debate and understanding by everybody.
Well, I agree with you there, and then that's why I'm saying I'm more sympathetic with this formula as a tentative step forward in solving the problem. I would rather it be in statutory rather than constitution, but the question you brought up too. But I'm taking it now as a good compromise step with the two forces that are against taxes or total abuse of public dividend.
Representative
Mary. No, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to make a few points here, Mary, that's going through. One of the things, of course, is what the resolution would do is, if going into the Constitution, it would go up to a vote. And that was one of the things that I was advocating, whether you're talking about other revenue sources as far as income tax, you know, and this thing. I think the people are part of the loop. And, you know, and that gets to be a philosophical question, not that we should go up to a vote whether we're going for an income tax or for this. But in the past, we've been looking at the discipline of the legislature as far as dealing with these monies that are on the table. So I think the proposal is valid from that point. On the dedicated funds side of it, you do come up with a question, but we have seen legislation that has moved forward that we're getting into this quasi-dedicated fund area on, you know, mental health trust lands and a few other things that's going on. On the appropriations of the legislature and their duties, there still would be that 30% that would be able to appropriate with this funding formula. But I guess getting down to the constitutional side of it, and the question is the fact that if we adopted this in this particular way, and in the worst case scenario, we had difficulties, we could not live with it, and we were into it, I think, what kind of a time span are we looking at in repairing that loop?
It calls, under the proposal itself, it calls for legislature to act with three-fourths, but they could only act if the revenues drop, including the budget reserve revenues, dropped below the 80% level of the year before, and then only with a 3/4 vote of each body. That would that'd be a real hard way to do business if we had another problem like we had this last year, or this year. Oh, they went to back to your third vote, sorry.
Not impossible,
I think.
Well, not impossible, but a 20% drop in revenues in a single year, a 10% drop in revenues, as those of you who are having to deal with the budget aspects of what's going on this year, is a major change in the amount of money that's being allocated. Given the resistance that we're having to even 10% cuts, you can imagine what a 20% cut would be in terms of. And also, it does. So many of those fiscal questions are questions of timing, where we go out with school debt retirement, and there's a schedule on which that has to be paid, regardless of all the other considerations. So our principal objection to this is very simply the idea that you enshrine it in the Constitution and using the Constitution as a checkbook rather than as a policy document.
Any other questions?
I have that question. That's important to me. Is that your principal objection? Mm-hmm. If 40-30-30 was presented by itself, to set the Constitution aside, would you be supporting it then?
I don't know if we would be supporting that particular allocation, but we would not have any trouble supporting a statutory allocation of earnings.
Okay. So you think the premise of the entire thing.
Yeah, the premise of our objection to this is the constitutional enshrinement rather
than. If I may comment, probably the reason, and I talked briefly to Governor Hammond about this, is the lack of faith in politicians and the people who are making the decision. I said, if it's locked into the Constitution, they'll have to do it. And that's an indictment of the system itself, but unfortunately, I think it's warranted. But you would if it's the 40-30-30 was there, or a formula approach to it.
We, in fact, would very much like to work with the legislature if there's not an allocation formula designed this session, which seems rather remote at this point, over the interim, and looking at the pros and cons of different proposals, because it is very clear that some sort of new approach is probably going to be needed by next session.
Well, and everybody has something in place. I mean, before the price of oil goes back, I don't quite know what it is. I don't have the answer.
Ms. Halloran, it is, this issue is on the interim work plan for this committee, and unless something radical changes in the next 36 to 48 hours, it is my intent to allow the public to get to understand this proposal and alternatives to it over the summer so that there is adequate public understanding and exposure to the concept. Representative Martin.
Madam Chairman. May I ask also if the committee would ask the Attorney General, because I think it's been ridiculous, and Mr. Belch has been the Lieutenant Governor, and at times has had to make controversial opinions on ballot initiatives and ballot questions. And we can get a history where the governor, whether it was in office or his AG, went different ways on the same question. Now, the Lieutenant Governor today turned down the voter's right to vote on revenue taxation. He said that it was unconstitutional, that was a source of appropriations. However, the governor, in his announcement on his original last program, he came out with the voted vote one way or the other, said that it is constitutionally right that people have to vote on taxing and even initiate the action. Well, I told him that was contrary to exactly what the AD before him said. He said, well, he's wrong. I think we really need to know where we stand legally on it before even working time one way or the other. Because elections have been thrown out on constitutional questions, as you know.
Representative Davidson, do you still have a question?
Well, it's pretty much been touched upon. I would like to hear how the administration is going to deal with the idea of protection as regards the permanent fund as in the context of keeping that flexibility. I know that we're getting fogged up, if you will, in another original intent situation, and it seems like we're headed for more trouble down the road, and I was just wondering if the administration has in fact been trying to address the idea of some kind of permanence of the permanent fund.
The the only way that we're going to be able to protect the permanent fund in the future is to protect inflation proofing. It's very clear that if you don't inflation proof adequately in the long run, you can drastically alter the amount of the principal, which in turn will alter the ability of the fund to give off earnings for whatever use the legislature wants to put them to. So I think that has to be kind of be very well discussed, how to best do inflation proofing. There are different ways we could think about it.
Any other questions? Any other comments? We do have Barry Hay who wants to testify. Representative Helfer, do you have a question from this audience? Okay. Barry Hay.
And the only other thing, Madam Chairman, is that the actual effects of this particular proposal are summarized for you on page 2 of the handout, which, if I could just say, it does have certain very effects which would have to be discussed in terms of what other effects of other proposals are, not to be evaluated on their own, but just what the other proposals might also do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wish to speak to committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution Number 40 this afternoon. My name is Barry Haight. I represent the Burbank Central Labor Council, AFL-CIO. I'm going to speak in opposition to this legislation. I would like to speak it in terms of the general concept of it and not necessarily the details of the legislation itself. As you know, the AFL-CIO is acutely aware of the revenue and financial problems facing the state today. We have taken stands and looked into the various ways to deal with the problem. And basically what we've said is that we would support taxes on the people after certain other revenue enhancement measures were taken. They haven't been taken, and this is a tax on the people. What we're proposing to do here with the permanent fund is take it away from the Alaskan resident that it belongs to and in effect give it to the oil companies as profits. And I'm referring to the fact that this body as a whole has failed to deal with the economic limit factor in this session, a major source of revenue that could and should be dealt with before we go back to a personal income tax, before we tap or raid the permanent fund, and before we continue on other forms of taxes, such as laying public workers off and diminishing their wages and benefits. We feel very strongly about that. We've worked diligently in this legislative session. We've worked with the public on it, and we want to continue to do so. After having creating a smoke screen, you're creating an argument within an argument that obscures the other things that we need to do. This legislation will allow for annual tapping of the permanent fund when other methods could and should be used. We aren't convinced that it actually inflation-proofs the fund, and it's really overall sort of a band-aid approach. So we would stand in opposition, and we would support your idea of hanging on to this legislation and getting more input from the public on it.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes. Barry, do you have you given any thought to suggestions or ultimate suggestions? I think you got to agree that we'll spend every dime that's on the table.
Well, Representative Boucher, I've given one of them. We stand firmly saying let's deal with the economic limit factor first, and if that isn't sufficient, then we would, in an order of appropriateness, be supportive of other revenue measures, whether that was a return of an income tax or whether it was tapping into the permanent fund. What we're doing here is though we're tapping this fund first without doing those other things.
Any other questions? Representative Menard.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So Barry, if I understand you, your recommendation is the ELF number one and then possibly an income tax down the road, but did you have other suggestions besides the ELF?
Not at this time. That's a number one, and I'm not so sure that we would recommend the personal income tax before using the permanent fund, but we certainly object to any of those before that ELF is dealt with.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who would like to testify in SJR 40?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Fry, please try this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt O'Fry, and I'm the president of the Alaska AFL-CIO, and would like to echo Barry Haight's words and also add just a couple other thoughts for your consideration. One of them being, we've heard time and time again this session how the economic limit factor can't be changed because that deal was made several years ago, and now you can't go back on your deal. Well, the permanent fund distribution was just as firm a commitment because the legislature did that too. And I think it would be a real shame if indeed, in a one-year period, looking at the numbers that I read anyway, in a one-year period, you're going to cut a dividend by more than $200 per person, per Alaska resident. And you will hurt the very people that need the money the most. So to speak just a little bit more on what Barry was saying, first of all, that distribution goes to Alaska residents. The last group that you should want to harm, not the first group. The economic limit factor at a time when Prudhoe Bay oil production is at an all-time high, the economic limit factor should certainly be the first of the priorities. And then after that, if there was an income tax reimposed, even if it were a minimal amount, at least then you would get something from the many non-residents that are working in this state. So that should certainly be not below reducing the permanent fund, but above reducing the permanent fund as far as priority. Because there are still many, many working in the North Slope area, the Prudhoe Bay area, right now, many non-residents that commute. And Alaska realizes not a single dime in any kind of revenue. At least an income tax would get a little bit of money from those non-residents. And I am glad to hear that there's going to be a continuation through the interim, because I think it's certainly premature to try to get this and rush it onto the ballot. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Hunt.
Yeah, thank you. I was hoping that Mr. Five would give me an opportunity, hopefully during the summer, to give you more detail on the income and what we already heard. Because we all gripe about the out-of-state workers, and there's nasty old people taking these jobs that we don't want, like in the fishing plant and in the tourist business are too low paying. But the main thing is that before we use that as an excuse to sell income tax, it's definitely going to be less than 10% of the total tax that out-of-state payers pay, and it's
sure.
More likely to be 5%. So should we tax ourselves 95% just to get those dirty old guys who dare to come up here and work and take jobs that our people don't want? Because they lose workers' comp, they lose welfare, and all kinds of things. They lose just not worth it to them to take those jobs.
Well, you know, there
except
are
some, and you're right on the slope, but not the bulk.
Well, there are some things happening that's real encouraging in my point of view. Commissioner Labor has a special assistant whose primary job is to try to encourage Alaska resident hire and try to promote it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he is setting up programs within the Department of Labor, Job Services Division, and the fisheries, the different private fisheries groups, and is promoting hiring Alaskans for some of those jobs. And I really think that that's a big plus. As far as an income tax goes, whoever would have thought the AFL-CIO would be the one saying, let's have an income tax. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. I had to scoot my chair back and make sure lightning didn't come down. But as a matter of fact, an income tax would at least, especially if it was a percentage, you would extract a tax from, certainly on a graduated basis, from those who could afford to pay it. Not like the permanent fund, cutting off the permanent fund from those people who are truly needed. Each year there are many that look forward to, you see in the paper, people willing to sell it for 50% of the value because they need the money. Now, an income tax wouldn't hurt those people at all because they wouldn't earn enough to pay it. So, and the other thing, if there is a plus about an income tax, the other good point about it is that still, even under the new tax laws of the United States, an income tax is deductible where a sales tax and other forms are not deductible from federal tax purposes. So I think that it may not be a tasteful pill, but maybe it's a medicine that'll help cure the illness.
Any other questions from the Ron. Thank you,
yeah,
Mr.
just
Benjamin.
Basically, let's set aside just for a moment for other approaches. I guess the thing that I have is something that's needed, some type of control system.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought this forward as a system. You know, I guess what, and I'm hearing pretty much the same public out there saying, I don't want the income tax, I don't want a sales tax, I want my permanent fund, I don't want to lose my annuity, you know, and you really get through.
That's right.
And I one thing I do is, make pardon?
They want all the services.
Yeah, well, and that's right. But I guess that I detect more than anything else a hostility with the decisions and confusion on the thing. And I'd have to say that some type of discipline. We're kind of like playing on a football field with no markers on the thing. The game just goes back and forth. And I guess what this is saying is, okay, 100 yards and so why? And let's set aside the arguments that you and I know, and I share deeply the same concerns that you do. But shouldn't we begin to think of something where we're going to say, all right, this much for it, inflation proofing, and this much for the dividends, as much for the public's protection as anything else, that at least you would have a set of ground rules. So let's just talk about the concept for a minute, and maybe not just this one.
Yeah, Representative Boucher, I agree with that possibly, in fact, that's why I applaud the chairman's decision to, or the committee's decision to work on this through the interim, because I think that's an excellent forum and at least a little time instead of trying to rush something through.
Yeah.
I think that's through the interim is a time when we can finally sit down, maybe assess and see what the impact and what the, by using different formula, not necessarily 40-30-30, but maybe 30-40-30, you know, who knows what the, but taking a look at different formulas and seeing just what it means, what the impacts are. And of course with I don't envy the decisions that this body has to make in only a matter of a couple of days, but just one further beating the drum, as long as Bradley Lake and the Interties rush through and find their way to the street this year, I'll be happy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fry. Is there anyone else who is here today? SJR 40.
Well, it's Bradley
one
Lake
final
and the Interties.
Senator Melbourne. Thank you, Mr. Fry.
I hear the bells ringing for our side, and we all salivate or something whenever signal goes off. I think the thing that was important to me is that we had to consider something in light of what was going on right now. I fully support Representative Boucher's efforts to get a task force going. But if, in fact, we're going to take money out of the earnings of the permanent fund this year, then does a task force this summer represent anything more than a pregnancy test?
That's a good way to put it.
I am opposed to spending any of the revenue of the permanent fund until we guarantee that we won't spend all the rest of it. And it doesn't matter. You've got a good resolution out of this committee. If that came back and that were to be guaranteed before the voters, I'd vote for it. Because then we'd be guaranteeing that they knew what the ground rules were and they weren't going to get repealed by a statute the very next year. The chief executive has said essentially that he would repeal the dividends. They're opposed to anything in the Constitution because it makes it more difficult to repeal the dividends. I disagree with that position very strongly.
Senator Helfer, just so you know, there, as far as I'm concerned, there are a lot of good things in SJR 40, and some of them I have been a supporter of for a long time, and there are certain attractions, as far as I'm concerned, to institutionalizing them. But it is a major step, and unless leadership makes this a priority and all of a sudden it disappears from my committee, I really think it would do better to have the public discussion rush into something like this so that there's a more clear understanding of what's going on. And I think unless you have that, its chances of actually being adopted are reduced.
I understand the position you find yourself in as someone who wants to do everything they can personally to try and protect the permanent fund and looking at this budgetary situation. I hope we find a solution that doesn't already have violated the permanent fund before we get to the solution.
We really need to go on to the longevity.
Madam Chair, just one question that I asked. He put it rather bluntly about a pregnancy test. I mean, that's right. If it's after the fact, it's no damn good. But might 40-30-30 with, let's say, through the budget year, so there could be some safety valve. Does that make sense, you know? I mean, maybe people don't like
it. Statutory, I'd like to see that.
Well, I'm talking about, okay, so nobody's got any better suggestions, so we just use it at least through a budget year, so in case the price of oil goes to 22 and somebody gives us $1 billion, the thing isn't blown before we can get it. I mean, has there been any thought given to that?
In fact, you don't have to do that because you have an existing law that you would leave in place that would guarantee existing dividends, existing inflation proof, in fact, less inflation proofing than 40-30-30 would provide for this year and next year. But you have a reserve account that's there. The reserve account is where any action would take place in the next year, so that's what the House is considering. And my only point is that I can't vote for a budget that depends on the reserve account and its final vote, or its effective date, or taking the money until I know that the voters are going to have a chance to reclose the door after we've pried it open.
Well, my only problem with that just is, from what I'm getting, and I can show you a stack of about 1,000 I've received in the last 48 hours, they don't know what's going on. They're just angry at everything and anything. You got to read some of these things. You know, I mean, they said, really, they're angry. Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Helfert.
Thank
SB 56. Is Beth okay?
We have a brief recess for just a second.
Very brief. We're going to 40-30-30.
What are you, 40-30?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
64-40, you're fine.
56. That's what we're on right now.
Senator Curtula sends his apologies. He's on the floor of the Senate right now, so I'm here in his place. Along with me are two people that are much more expert in the field than I, John Tillinghast and Paul Escobarra. Both of them worked with the Hammond Commission, and both of them put in a lot of hours this year and previously concerning the annuity plan and other options for our longevity bonus program. I'm going to try and be brief, but I appreciate the chance to come before you today on the bill. The crux of the matter to Senator Curtula is that Senate Bill 56 would preserve the dignity of our elderly and help those originally sought to be helped remain in Alaska, along with new seniors. Nationwide, more than 12% are over 65. In Alaska, we have only 3% over that age, so you see there's a vast disparity between our state and the rest of the United States. We have a high cost of living. Many seniors are on fixed incomes, and many have no Social Security. I think we're lucky to have those who remain, and I think everybody in the room feels that way. The problem, of course, is what are we going to do about the cost of the program, and what are we going to do to change our program? In 84, the Supreme Court struck down the old longevity bonus program. We let in people who have had one-year residency and are over 65, and the current program today costs more than $51 million. In the year 2001, it's going to equal about $83.6 million, and in 2005, if we remain the same, it's going to be about $95 million. Senate Bill 56 is one method of bringing the costs down while hopefully preserving the dignity of those who are on it. Last year, the House and the Senate considered the problem. The House came up with a stair-stepping scenario, which is quite similar to House Finance's program right now, which is basically a cutoff for anyone who isn't 65 by a certain date. The Senate annuity approach lets program continue with a different format. Ms. Halloran's here from the governor's office, and I know you're quite familiar with the needs or income-based system that the governor has proposed. Senate Bill 56 would essentially allow a person to start an annuity account that would grow an amount and the government would continue funding a declining longevity bonus amount so that if a person contributed 100% of his or her permanent fund dividends every year, the amount, the total amount of annuity and longevity bonus would never be equal to less than $250 a month. Because some people won't have long to build up their annuity account, we're going to be doing that declining longevity bonus. There's questions that have arisen. I know that the committee probably has questions. One change in Senate Bill 56 that was added in is that assurance that if you put in 100% of your permanent fund dividends, you'll always get the $250 a month. The earlier version of Senate Bill 56 didn't actually insure that because it was basing the declining longevity bonus amount on the youngest person in the program. That person would have had a longer time for their annuity to build up, so your longevity bonus would have declined a little faster, the general fund contribution. So that's why the CS is a little more costly, is because now we're basing our declining longevity bonus on the oldest person in the program. That person's going to be buying annuities every year. They won't have as long for the amount to build up, so that's why it's a little bit more costly in this version than the original 7.56. That is really the crux of the bill. John and Paula are here, and I think, just to close my comments, I think economically this is a straight money, this is straight unencumbered funds into our economy. This is money that's spent in Alaska. I'm concerned about what happens if we take away this program, really what the impact on our welfare programs will be. And finally, I think that the seniors are spending this money wisely, and that we should not necessarily be in the business of telling them how to spend it, or in terms of just trying to figure out who should get the money based on income, or who should get the money solely based on when they turn age 65. The annuity allows people to make the choice of if they want to set aside their money. It is optional, but it will give everyone who's in the state over 65 years of age and has been here 1 year at least a declining longevity amount. So in a sense, it's a phase out with the added plus that the person can set aside money for their future. Thank you, Madam Chair. If there are questions.
There are.
Yep.
Representative Dahlman.
Well, I have two main questions. Number one, the Senate plan, do people still have to give up, do they have to give up their permanent fund dividends to participate? Okay, they do.
Yes.
And second, are people locked in at the stair steps? If you retire in 1990 and there's been 2 years and the annuity program's been active and the annuity amount, annual amount is, say, $16 by then or something, when you retire, does it lock in at a particular amount or does it get lower and lower and phase out?
The amount of your annuity will stay the same. It'll say $16, but your aggregate payment will decrease because the longevity bonus will keep decreasing. So in order to stay at 250, you have to keep contributing that permanent fund dividend until the day you die.
Madam Chair, how different is that than the proposed committee substitute?
Well, the proposed committee substitute is set at 225 instead of 250. As a result, the declining balance is calculated for a lower amount. And in essence, instead of guaranteeing that there would be 225, the amount which the state would contribute is basically set as a schedule. And if the annuity does as well as expected, the person will get 225. But if it doesn't, it will be reduced by the lower rate of return, which the annuity will come up with. So it adds a little more certainty in terms of what the state of Alaska contribution would actually be, and it will remain to be seen how well the annuity does. Representative Martin.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd like to. Is there a date of entry and a period of eligibility when people must make up their mind to commit themselves to this? Like, is this permanent fund dividend check it, or can I wait for another 5 years and then it's worthwhile when I'm 60 and then just pay for the last 5 years?
You make a separate election every year as to that year's dividend, and the election can be no contribution this year, 25% next year, 100% the next year. And in fact, that may well happen because the way these annuities grow, in order to guarantee yourself something like 250, you really don't have to start contributing until you're about 50 years old.
That's what I'm saying. So there seems to be a factor here. You mentioned before, I think, that Mr. Donnelly's question, that you contribute your whole check right now. But why should I, or why should a two-year-old boy or girl check be contributed? There's no guarantee that he'll get more or less than myself, who paid maybe just for the last 10 years into the pot.
Well,
Well, see what I'm saying? I'll pay a lot less, and in 1 year I got my money back. Probably 3 years. Than the kid who's, you know, just 10 years old. There's a lot of disparity, it seems like. Nothing equal, does it?
If I might, through the chair, I think one of the things about the annuity plan is that it allows people to make up their minds whether or not they want to participate in the program. We're faced with the declining revenues, and it's one method to do it. Maybe I'm not totally understanding the problem. It takes about 15 years to build up to $250 a month, and I think that's what Mr. Telengast was referring to. If you started putting your money in 15 years, you build up to being out at 250 a month. The oldest senior on the program, you're right, doesn't have a long time to build the money up to 250 a month, and that's why we've got the declining longevity bonus in it, to take care of those people. Those people don't have as long a lifespan as the person who's 2 or 3 years old. If that person wants to start right away and contribute 100% of their dividend, they're going to get a lot more money than 250 a month. That's true.
Well, that's
they'll have a chance
to build
plan up.
That, you know, if you put that in there, like your own personal annuity plan, you're going to get more than that, and that needs to be explained.
That's true.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Beth, on the, so there still is the variation on the contribution. You can contribute 25, 50, 75, 100%, somewhere in there. Is that window still left in it to where some folks will be left out in the fact where no one will be left out? They always, in other words, there was a window that if you didn't turn 65 before a certain date, you would be cut out.
I don't think that's not, there isn't any window cutting anybody out now. Now maybe I'm misinterpreting something.
Well, the amount of general fund money that they get by date.
Well, that will differ, that will go down. The general fund amount will decline through the chair, excuse me. It will decline based on, you know, the annuity amount that continues growing for the oldest senior. So that's true. If you're coming in at a later date, or if you're moving up to the state and you've only had 1 year in Alaska, so you've only contributed 1 year of your permanent fund dividends, that amount will be a lot less than someone who's been here and had a chance for it to grow.
Okay. Now, what happens, like what Representative, through the chair, what Representative Martin was talking about is someone did not want to put 100% of their dividend in. And say they took their dividend and put it in their own annuity, an insurance annuity or something like that, and allowed that to build up, and then when they got to be close to the mark, they switched over and started going into the annuity and then picked up.
Through the chair, we can't control what people do with private annuities or private money or IRAs or private investment plans.
Right.
We're allowing someone to enter into the annuity program with the state. They can do it really at any time they want to do it, and in 25% increments, so they could do that. Again, if they're only on the program 1 or 2 years, their annuity account with the state's not going to have a long time to build up. We're phasing out the entire general fund contribution somewhere around the year 2008. It's completely out for the state, so it would be a whole, basically, owned individual accounts by that time.
So 2008, it does phase out. Phases out on a formula according to what the annuity earns and everything else.
That's right.
Through the chair, actually, the declining bonus, there is a grandfather class of people who will get $250 a month for the rest of their lives, and that's people who were born before January 1, 1988. That would make it a much more generous bill. Who turned 65 before January 1, 1988. Everybody else will get this declining bonus. The declining bonus phases out in 2003 or 2004. General funding doesn't phase out until probably 2008 because some of the grandfathered class who are getting 250 will still be around.
I'm still concerned about this gap. I know that as soon as the person tomorrow is 64 and next year is 65, she may be 62 and in 3 years she's 65. So she gives her annuity for the next 3 years. She's only going to get that interest diameter on that. She's not going to be guaranteed the 250 a month. At what time does a 250 a month not exist for new entrants, no matter what age?
person, let's take the hypothetical person who is 62 now, yeah, and becomes 65 through years. That person, if that person puts away their annuity account or 100% of their dividend every year for those 3 years, and then keeps doing it after they turn 65, that person will get $250 a month. They won't get an annuity of $250
a month. She has to keep doing it.
She has to keep doing it.
So when in a year or two or five, one will give them dividends at $1,700, she's going to lose it, just end up with $1,300 ahead.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're about to lose. Oh, we just got back from our
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I just wanted to keep a quorum, and we just got to go chair our committee. So
I'm along there, then they are going to lose. They're not going to get as much because they have to continually get out the annuity.
That's correct. Now, there's, as a practical matter, if you don't put, if you're 70 years old and you don't put your year 70 annuity in the annuity account, your annuity the next year will be slightly smaller. Your net take will be perhaps 240 rather than 250. At that point in a person's life, they'll probably simply opt to take the dividend in cash and suffer the 10% a month decline.
Well, then, those who are in today, are they going to have to give up their annuity to stay in the program?
Seniors,
they're going to be getting the $3,000 plus their dividend.
Seniors who are 65 on or before January 1, 88 will get the $250 in general funds for life and get to keep their permanent fund dividends as cash.
But not the lady that's 62 or 64.
There are really two classes of seniors.
Two
okay?
classes of citizens.
There's a grandfathered group. Mm-hmm. If you are 65 before January 1 of 1988, mm-hmm, you get your money regardless. You get to get your money plus your dividend. You don't have to pay anything in. It doesn't matter what your annuity is. I mean, there's, you get it, okay? That group's been grandfathered under this bill. The other group of seniors, if you're not 65 to January 1st, 1988, is treated differently. You get $250 or $225, depending upon what version you got. But some of that is coming from the state general fund, and some of it is coming from the annuity. If you choose not to be in the annuity, okay, then you don't get that money from your annuity. So then you get less and less and less. So, I mean, there are several different categories of citizens, actually. I mean, there's those who are grandfathered, there's those who select the annuity, and then there are seniors who do not select the annuity.
And now we get back to the Zobel case. Who got here first and got in the program first?
I don't know. Do you have a legal opinion on that?
I mean,
there's it's not like the Zobel case. You're discriminating on the basis of who was in the program and who was not eligible for the program at the time that you terminated the old program. And I think the courts recognize that government spending programs have to come to an end and allow governments to protect those who are already in the program as opposed to those who are not yet eligible.
There's one factor here that I never hear. There is an attrition, you know. People my age are dropping all over. So what you do is just pass the bill and say, die quick. You know?
But there are lots of young seniors who are turning into old seniors.
All of this nonsense that's going on currently of pitting seniors against the children is a lot of damn nonsense. And it's perpetuated by irrational hey. I'm going to die. Somebody will be able to get whatever I get. And probably what I'll do is what I do. I would donate my dividend. Because I happen to think I was one of the ones that felt that at 65, you should have a choice. You shouldn't be able to have both the dividend and the other. And many of the seniors that I talked to said, hey, that's fine. We kind of plan on this as a balance. Well, mm-hmm, that didn't come to be, and I think that there's been a lot of agonizing, and any way you look at it, this is a Solomon decision. Something's going to have to be, you know, be cut. But the only thing that's bothered me throughout the testimony, Madam Chair, is, well, compare it with a single woman with a child. I mean, deal with each case itself. Society should deal with that. You shouldn't beat a certain class of people over the head and pit them against each other. And there's an article that all of us got that deals with just that type of nonsensical rhetoric. Hey, we have the generation gap and the gender gap and this gap and all the other crap. And I think that what we need to do is deal specific with the problems, not pit one segment of our society.
That's why the government is very beautiful. People in this state will go for need and helping those that need.
Yeah. Representative Menard?
Yes, Madam Chair.
under your version, what happens since Representative Boucher is bringing up the fateful event that we all shall meet death? What happens at death in the
through the chair, the person has the option of choosing death benefits under the annuity plan. If they choose the death benefits, it probably will bring their payment down slightly under $250 a month because they'll be paying the death benefits. So they can choose the death benefits and it can be passed as inheritance. Otherwise, if they don't choose death benefits, and then Mr. Tillinghast, correct me if I'm incorrect, it just lapses back to the state. Is that right?
No,
pardon me.
No, it goes to the survivor.
Goes to the survivor.
It's just
so it does not lapse back to the state.
Okay. As most private
Madam Chair, what is your desire to move this out of committee?
Well, there's at least one more person who wants to testify. Mary Halloran is here who wants to testify.
No, no, I'm talking about today.
Well, somebody would like us to.
I would like to move it out. There's one thought that I came to think of, and I think of it in my own case, you know, I'm for real, I'm there. I thought that how great it would be to power up the annuity. Let's say, for example, I had the option to put all or any portion after age 65 into that annuity. In fact, I would like to participate in an annuity that my survivors might well benefit from that, you know. And that's the only concern with me, that a person after age 65 does not have an opportunity, am I correct there, to participate in the annuity.
The bill, it's through the chair, the bill is written so that it would be people under 65 as of January 1, 88.
You might find a lot of people over 65 might, just especially some that might afford it, would put that in it, which would put more money into the annuity. That's a suggestion that I have. I don't even know if it's been thought of or not.
I appreciate the suggestion. Through the chair, if I might just comment on the committee substitute on the work draft on page 3. It's section 7. I really appreciate the chair's effort and the thought of reducing the bonus and then bringing down the general fund contributions is one that's been mentioned before and, you know, is certainly one option. However, in section 7, we're talking about not letting a monthly longevity bonus exceed the bonus amount for that fiscal year set out in Case B, Table 1 of the Alaska State Legislature. It's a research memorandum. I'm just very concerned about that section. I think that the aim of the rest of the bill is to try and hit at least $225 a month. I'm afraid that this might not do that. Also, we haven't had a chance to run it by an actuary or really study to make sure that that would meet with the intent of the rest of the bill. So I would just point that out as just a concern. I'm sorry.
It does go to finance after here, and we don't have much time left.
Certainly,
section,
I understand.
So I have a feeling she's talking about section 7 on page 3.
It's just something I wanted to raise.
On lines which? That's
lines 19 through 27.
Okay.
Through the chair, two real quick comments. I think that you the Case B Table 1 is based on a $250 bonus, unless has there been a revised one? Oh, there's been a revised
it's attached.
One. Okay. Okay, I had an old one.
Okay.
The only other comment would be that the Case A and Case B numbers were not done by an actuary. So if your goal is to ensure that you don't have any unpleasant surprises down the pike in terms of general fund obligations, this obviously does it. If your goal is to adopt a table that's actuarially sound, it obviously doesn't.
That is the trade-off, of course. The trade-off is who, to what extent can the state of Alaska make up the difference between an imaginary amount and an imaginary annuity, okay? And this approach says that the state has a declining obligated amount to pay to seniors. They can count on it. They know what it is. It declines. It's predictable. The annuity, which is voluntary, very much like a private annuity, may raise more, it may raise less. We don't really know because it's an uncertainty. There are a lot of uncertainties, but it will provide something in addition to this scheduled amount. this simply says that the state of Alaska isn't guaranteeing what that additional amount is. That will be up to the individual. Okay, Mary Halloran, what is
Will you want that section out then, or reconsider, or what?
I don't completely understand the section, except to say that, through the chair, I believe what the chair is saying is that that lets us know how much money we're giving out of the general fund. Doesn't necessarily mean we're going to add up the $250 a month for someone, and that's my concern about it. Could, I think it could drop off faster than that. I'm just not concerned. That's my problem. Excuse me.
Through the chair, the intent of the amendment, though, is that if the maximum possible annuity were to grow faster than anticipated in this table, you would use the actual numbers.
That's correct.
It would
that's
only
my
be
understanding.
Slower.
Let me say that. That is my understanding. This is all a little new for all of us, so we're going to just sort of group here. Mary Halloran.
With the economic, you'll make it.
A group growth? Like
no,
that?
I meant with the economy. You'll make what you
want.
It
means everybody staggers around.
This is typical for the end of the session.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Group growth.
Sounds appropriate.
I'm glad this is a nice one. Madam Chair, my comments are directed to the Senate Judiciary CS, not the proposed House State Affairs CS. And in fact, the House State Affairs CS answers some of the concerns that I would raise about the bill that's actually before you from the Senate. First, and very simply, the annuity proposal is not responsive to the state's fiscal situation. And the cost of the annuity increases over the next several years, but it's clear that our revenues are not on the upward swing. It not only calls for full general fund costs for all seniors who are currently in the program, but it also provides for some amount of general fund costs in the declining amount for seniors who enter the program after the first of the fiscal year, or the calendar year. Second, and this is probably even more troubling, is that the proposal assumes that permanent fund dividends continue at their projected levels through the year 2002. If the permanent fund dividend is somehow changed, capped, suspended, eliminated, whatever the case might be in the future, the state's general fund obligation could be substantially greater than is estimated currently. And you all know how that works at this point. And that's explained at length in the Attorney General's memo on that issue. Also, just shifting the cost of the program for new entrants from the general fund to the permanent fund ignores the fact that at somewhere around 1994 to 1997, the Prudhoe Bay revenue curve and the permanent fund earnings stream are crossing over. And to pre-dedicate any one use of the permanent fund earnings stream to a state program at this time seems injudicious to us, I guess is the best adjective for it. Third, and this is the one, is the area that I have the most personal concern about, is that I believe the annuity proposal establishes a state Social Security program only for those Alaskans who are wealthy enough to forego the permanent fund dividend today. It says basically that we're willing to provide additional general fund money in the future for those Alaskans who can not spend their permanent fund dividend today. And I just find that an unfortunate proposition. Fourth, and this is again a fiscal concern, the annuity proposal doesn't address the loss of federal funds that we currently face, the Hold Harmless funds. Those are about $4 million this year and are estimated to grow at least $500,000 annually over the next several years. In addition, it doesn't address the potential Medicaid coverage loss for seniors who do participate in the annuity. The Hess position paper explains very clearly how that would work and the potential problem there. And then finally, we're not at all sure that this program, if enacted, would work. The annuity program offers no tax advantages, unlike the state's deferred compensation program, yet the deferred compensation program is not well used by those who could use it. There are very difficult choices here for people who are in low incomes, and the attached Hess position paper explains those at length. And the for most other individuals, an IRA would be a better deal than the annuity in terms of control and the type of the investment made and the potential return to the person. I do stand corrected in my paper, as Paula has been able just to point out to me, that it appears that the last draft of the, or one of the drafts of the...
It's in the original.
In the original chapter, that we did already speak to the problem of survivor benefits last 2 years ago, although at one point that was an issue. I had thought we were, again, not providing for survivor benefits appropriately. So with all that, if you did, in fact, end up with low participation in the program, if people were really fully informed about what its potential meant to them as individual investors, the administrative cost of the program would take a larger proportion of the earnings than might be currently anticipated, which would, again, reduce the annuity amounts and raise the general fund costs. So, as I noted, Madam Chair, the House Speaker